You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Fosma Moon, and Seth Miller.
Hello, and welcome to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, episode 311. It is October 1st when you're hearing this show if you are not a Patreon subscriber. Today, it's myself, Stephen Seagraves, and Seth Miller. Foz is not with us. He got called away last minute, so it's just the two of us. Just the two of us.
We can make it if we try.
I almost broke into song.
I'm pretty sure I've done that one before, but that's okay. Apparently, I'm in a mood.
Yeah, you are in a mood. You're in a mood. I'm in a mood too.
What that mood is?
It's I think it's the mood of I'm voting for the tsunami in 2020.
Definitely not.
That's how I feel.
Okay,
that's my mood.
I cleaned out my travel backpack, like carry-on bag, this afternoon because my in-laws are coming to visit and I had to put some stuff away, and it had been sitting on the floor in our kitchen, apparently, our dining room, for, oh, I don't know, 7.5 months now. And so I found all the old boarding passes from our trip to India and Nepal and Tibet. And
was that the last time you touched it?
I think I took it out when we went on a bike ride.
Okay.
But like all that stuff was in one of the smaller pockets, and so I like threw water bottles and a spare battery pack and our medical kit in like the big pocket. Yep. But while I was down there, like, because I was in the kitchen, like next to the trash, I was like, I should clean it out before I carry it upstairs and have to deal with all the papers and stuff. So I found like 5 different hotel receipts and a bunch of boarding passes, like from all the different internal flights we took. I kept one. I recycled most of them, but I kept the Bhutan Airlines flight from Kathmandu to Paro because, A, it's a cool looking boarding pass, and B, that was just a great flight.
You don't keep them all?
No, you know, I did for a long time, and then one day I was staring at a stack of them, and I was like, why? And I threw them all away.
I've thought about like what I would do, because I have a box of them. I mean,
Right, this is the thing, it's like, but then what am I going to do?
Yeah, and I think my plan is eventually I'm going to make like a coffee table or something, like some kind of table or display of all of them, to where it's like my entire wall.
You might want to talk to Jess about whether it can be a coffee table or not. I got into a lot of trouble with that in beer bottle caps once.
Oh, well, yeah. Don't tell me my business.
I said might. I mean, but I'm in a mood, so I can say whatever I want.
I didn't mean to offend you. Speaking of which, it was Yom Kippur this past weekend. Yeah, happy Yom Kippur. I know
that's not really something you say.
Yeah, I didn't think that was. So I don't know a ton about it. I know it's the Day of Atonement, right? It's one of the biggest days, correct?
The biggest, usually.
Yeah.
Generally suggest hopes for a meaningful or easy fast. It's a fast day.
Oh, okay.
25 hours. So you do sundown, you know, from just before sundown to after sundown the following day.
And how did that go? Was it an easy fast?
It actually was, for me this year, a relatively easy fast. Often there's a nap involved because, you know, sleep time helps pass the not eating. I did not nap this year. I was doing some other things. I mostly avoided working. There's a bit of irony in that, you know, after services on Sunday night, I was thinking to myself, what am I going to do now? I've got, you know, a couple hours to kill before I'm ready to go to sleep. And I don't want to be sitting on my computer or on my phone or anything like that. I would like to just sort of be, you know, sort of meditative, if you will. And it's like, you know, it'd be nice is to like sit out on the deck and like just have a fire.
Mm.
And there's this funny thing about Judaism and the whole, like, you can't work on Shabbat.
Lighting a fire is
great. The literal text is make fire. Like, of all the things I could possibly thought of and picked, making a fire was the absolute worst. Like, it's not even like, well, it's not really that bad because, no, make fire is literally the translation in the Old Testament of what you're not supposed to do. So, yeah, I screwed that one up pretty good. In my thoughts, I didn't actually have the fire.
What do people typically do? Read or meditate, pray, that kind of thing?
It's mostly prayer and meditation. And some educational reading, I suppose, from time to time, sort of biblical study. But there's a lot of it is sort of internal reflection and meditation. And I guess it also sort of depends on how religious and observant you are. Anyway.
Well, I'm glad it went well. I think it's fascinating always to learn about this stuff. I haven't, you know, I've been exposed to it a little bit, but not a ton. So it's good to hear. We got a lot of topics. First, we got some follow-up, though. So 787s, we touched on this briefly. I believe it was last episode. We talked about how United is putting Polaris on the 787s, and we thought it was going to be all of the 787s, and it sounds like it sounds like it's just the Dash 8.
So far, it's just the Dash 8s that are confirmed, and this comes from, to be fair, a sales meeting call for corporate travel agents that I was listening in on.
Mm-hmm.
The United executive said basically all the Dash 8s, when they re-enter service, will have it or starting next spring, I guess, they should all have it. Hmm. And then he said the Dash 9s were sort of still out for consideration. And that's super weird to me because they're a much more flexible type.
There's more of them. And
it's a bigger fleet. They got bigger range. It's a bigger aircraft also, but there's, I don't know, they're more represented in the fleet, in the route map also. One of the interesting things that he said was that the longest routes, Bangalore, Singapore, and Joburg, mm-hmm. are guaranteed Polaris. There's actually a subfleet.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've seen 787-9s flying around with Polaris seats in them.
And so it turns out it's not just the Polaris that matters. And this comes back to sort of the Johannesburg route and the Bangalore route. They've got an engine upgrade.
Oh, so we were chatting about that a little bit. Like, what are they doing to make these?
How are they going to make the flights? Are there weight restrictions or anything like that? It turns out that there's a higher thrust engine that and this is very much the GE way of how do engines work. Of, like, we release the initial model, and then over time, and as they become more stable, they basically increase the thrust rating with software updates, right? The GE90s started, I want to say, at, like, a 70,000-pound thrust, and then were 72 and 74 or something like that. There were incremental updates over the life of the GE90s as well that have allowed them to have increased range for the same fuel burn.
So
without having to take something off the wing and replace it. That's really cool.
Yeah, I mean, so do you think this, like, when you say it's an incremental upgrade, one, is it an incremental upgrade that they can just, like, apply? Is this, like, a software patch?
Yeah.
Or is it really? Wow.
That's my understanding. It's, like, it's mostly software. And maybe there's a couple other little tweaks, but my understanding is it's mostly just software.
Wow. Okay. What about, you're saying this is a subfleet. I mean, if it's just software, why wouldn't you not install this on the entire 787-9 fleet?
I think that's the plan eventually. I think it's also, there is some cost to it.
Mm.
The GE90 ranges from 81,000 to 115,000 foot-pounds of thrust. So it's a wide range across what is a common design.
Yeah.
There are different models within it, but also even within that, there are, like, just the ones that are hanging off the ex-continental planes I know at United had, like, their ratings upgraded over time.
Yeah.
Anyway, why wouldn't you do it? I think you would. There's a cost factor and a time factor to do it. I'm not sure that it's like an immediate, like, okay, here's your patch, reboot, and the engine's good to go. There might be a little more to it than that, but
yeah.
I don't know for sure, honestly.
So what they're saying is that these specific 787-9s will be on Bangalore, Joburg, and Singapore. Those are the routes.
Those are the three he mentioned. I imagine there's probably some others that the subfleet goes to. Mm-hmm. But there's enough of them converted now that they can pull that off. So that was an interesting little bit of discovery. There's only one 772, and I think Foz called that appropriately, that most of the 77s have been converted. And that one, when it returns to service, will have Polaris, I think he said. And then the 764s are the other subfleet that's sort of waiting to figure things out.
Mm-hmm.
And those are all parked right now, so not so much to consider.
I could see the 764s going before the 763s.
Honestly. Going where?
Just leaving the fleet.
Yes. Okay. Yes, yeah. I could too. It's a small subfleet. It sort of makes sense in some ways, but the 787s can replace them like for like reasonably well.
Yeah, and then you can keep your kind of high J config if you need it, 763s on London whenever that reopens, route-wise. I don't know. It's interesting to me. Like, I think about Polaris. I think it's a better product across to on the ultra long haul routes. I think that's where it really comes in handy. So I'm thinking Singapore, man, 17, 18 hours in that over the two people next to each other is definitely, I mean, I love my wife, but I don't know that I'd want to sit next to her for 18 hours, let alone a stranger.
Hey, Jess, can you hear me?
I don't know. I don't know that you'd want to sit next to me.
More to the point. That's the way you need to phrase it. Just relationship advice here.
I mean, Foz and I did it, right?
Yeah.
And I can't remember. I think we switched like window seats like halfway through it because I had reserved a window seat. And I think Foz was like late to the upgrade. And like, so he took the aisle. And then I was like, oh, I'll be nice. Let him take the window for a little while and get away from the screaming child. yeah. So.
No, it's, there's definitely some value. And I don't know. I'm not quite as picky about the direct aisle access versus not thing, but
I think it's just a more comfortable seat.
I will give you that. I love the handle on top. I think the IFE is better. There's a lot of other things about it that are much nicer. I don't get too worked up over if I'm sitting next to someone, but that's also
very true.
I accept the fact that I'm in public transportation at the time.
I'm trying to remember what
what airplanes are?
No, no, yeah, well, that. I'm trying to remember what flight I was on. I was sitting next to a woman. She did not move the entire flight, and it was like 14 hours. I can't remember where I was. Might have been coming back from Taipei or something. It was a long flight, and she didn't move. She didn't eat, and she didn't move. It was weird.
See, I did my version of that story is when I did St. Martin to Paris on June, right as it was dying on the 340. I booked an award seat. I booked it late and couldn't figure out how to get my seat assignment or whatever, so I ended up in an aisle seat, which is definitely not my thing. And the woman next to me, it was her first time in business class. She was going to Paris for work, I think, and it was a big deal, and she wanted to be comfortable, and so she splurged for the upgrade. She wanted to make sure she was rested when she got there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All the reasons you read about for why someone would pick business class. And, like, this is the old June 340 with an angle flat seat and out of St. Martin, not the best catering in the world. And, like, and this was after the airport had been destroyed in the hurricane. So they were rebuilding it, but, like, no lounges. And you got in business class, like, I think a $15 voucher, which I used to buy a split of champagne at the local, the store. And, yeah, I had my glass of champagne before departure, just like I was supposed to, but fine. That was my version of lounge time. But she got on board, was like, wait, I got my own TV screen and, like, space to sit here? And I think she watched, like, Seinfeld reruns for 9 hours.
Oh my God.
I don't even know, like, but, like, I was like, hey, just so you know, like, if you need to get up or whatever, just climb over me or wake me up. I'm in the aisle seat. I understand it's, like, part of the deal, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, no, it'll be fine. I'm like, but seriously, if you need to, go ahead, because I'm going to sleep most of the flight. I put my earplugs in. I put my eye mask on. I may have had the meal. I don't think I did. And I woke up, and she was still sitting there just watching the TV. I was like, after she had told me about how, like, she wanted to be well-rested and this and that, I was like, yeah, you paid a lot of money for TVs.
Yeah, I'm always amazed by that in business class when I see even businessmen just, one, if they're in a suit, they don't take off the suit or, like, the suit jacket.
Or they take the entire suit off and they're walking around in their underwear.
Or that. But they, like, they don't even take the jacket off. And it's like...
Yeah, it's weird.
Yeah, it's weird. And you're going to be wrinkled. Like, I take my shirt off. I fold it. I do all these things. Because I want to look halfway decent when I land. I know my hair is going to be a mess or whatever, but I'd like to look kind of normal when I land. But I'm just amazed what people... I mean, I've seen people just... I mean, they get slosh drunk. And they're about to go to work, or they stay up the entire flight and they're wrecked. I mean, because you got to think about it, like, that wrecks you for the rest of the trip. And if it's like a 5-day trip, you know, and you're not adjusted at least a little bit at the beginning to where you're tired at night, you could be up all night. Like, from the West Coast, you could be up all night in Europe and with no problem. So I don't know. Anyway, I'm going off on a tangent, as is typical.
Yeah, but speaking of 767s, did you see that Delta's going to probably retire more of its 763s earlier?
Wow, I did not see that.
Yeah, I mean, we're still talking a few years out, but some of them are going to finally start to retire sooner on the 717. I think the 717s by 2023, and the 763s start leaving in 25.
I wonder, I mean, are they going to have enough 330 Neos and A350s to pick all that up? And is it too many seats on those planes?
I don't think it's all the 763s. Yes, they are much bigger. And they being the 350s and 330s. And they're also picking up 321 Neos. Presumably some of those can convert to LRs if they want to do long-haul stuff with fewer seats where it's the lower capacity and you don't need a twin aisle necessarily anymore.
Well, I wonder, like, if it's their tertiary – you know, they had a huge push for tertiary kind of airports to random destinations, right? So Portland, Narita, Portland, London – they're flying all those East Coast.
I would say those are secondary. I'd say the tertiary is, like, you know, random towns in, like, Pisa.
Raleigh, Durham to, you know, wherever.
Raleigh to Paris or JFK to Pisa, I would say it's more tertiary.
But what do you see them doing in that case? Like, even for Portland, like, I think they've had trouble filling the 76s they were using a 330 to Amsterdam from here. But Narita, which... If that moves to Haneda, I don't, which it is, but I just don't see them filling a 330 Neo.
Yeah, there's a weird dearth of what we'd call the NMA or middle market aircraft right now as an option. And so, you know, on the one hand, you take the cheaper to operate, even though, you know, on a trip cost basis, even though it's more seats and you just keep flying because you want to have the service. Or, right, again, we talked about this a little bit right now, like the entire market is resetting. And so do you write off some of those routes? Obviously, they have some corporate traffic that supports, you know, I think the Tokyo flights at least.
Yeah, to get into Southeast Asia for Nike and Intel.
Well, I always wonder about that, though, because they don't have a code share onward from Narita or from Tokyo, right?
Like, that's true.
Would you not move that to Incheon if that's what the real goal is?
Yeah. I mean, I know that so there's a large amount of Japanese O&D to Portland and Seattle. So I have a feeling it's partially that. I don't know. I think they struggle to fill the business class cabin on a regular basis, and that's why they reduced it. So
yeah, I that's sort of one of those situations where I wonder if, like, obviously the airlines have good data on this sort of thing, but like if ANA threw a 788 on that route,
yeah, better yet, JAL with the Alaska partnership.
JAL with Alaska, yeah. I mean, United would have the JV with ANA is where I was thinking American.
Oh, I got you, yeah.
American would have the JV with JAL, and JAL would also have the Alaska partnership, although it's just a partnership, not a joint venture, so it's a little less compelling. But I don't know. Those are things I think about.
Yeah. And from a larger view, like, let's step away from Portland, I wonder how many airlines are being strategic right now and they're planning centers and saying, hey, we need to look at what's going to happen to the landscape. I have a feeling that's happening a lot. But at the same time, I see it's just cuts mostly. And how do we save the airline?
I think there is some strategy, obviously, in play. But, you know, when you start looking at who's going where and who's doing what, and this might even play into one of the United stories that we've got coming up that we could get back vaguely onto our list of topics as opposed to, you know, for playing fast and loose here with the discussion. But the idea of sort of changing up what's acceptable as a route network, right? Does it have to be from a hub?
Yeah.
Can you start to pick and choose routes that are likely to generate a little bit more revenue and then see if maybe you can fill the seats?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, right? Like JetBlue, I feel like, has been more flexible on that front than the other U.S. carriers. But, you know, who knows if any of it will work is also the challenge. But, you know, at this point, you're also sort of calculating the numbers against incremental cost as opposed to real cost.
Yeah, yeah.
So that, right, like, it's you've already got the fixed cost of you own this airplane. Unless you declare bankruptcy, you can't return the lease. So what you really are just working against is the incremental cost of operating it against leaving it parked. And at that point, when you start doing the math that way, routes that otherwise would be an absolute no-go start to make sense. Now, at the same time, I cited JetBlue. JetBlue announced a whole bunch of new routes and a whole bunch of new service and is only operating like a fraction of what was originally published. And the company has been clear. They go through in a month out, they take a look at booking levels, and if the bookings are weak, they cancel the flight.
Yeah.
And if, you know, like 3 to 6 days out, again, they take a second look at the loads, and if the loads are low enough, they will, again, cancel flights because they're not willing to operate at a loss, but if it's, you know, close or it's just that incremental cost, they might.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, math going on to get this.
Which brings us to the idea of, should United return to JFK?
Hey, let's talk about that. There's rumors that it's going to happen.
Next year, no less.
Next year, which is just a few months away. Hard to believe. What do you think? I mean, is this real? Is this a pipe dream?
So we know Scott Kirby long ago bemoaned the fact, not that long ago, but when he right after he moved to United, so a few years ago, bemoaned the fact that United pulled out of JFK. And from what I remember, his positioning was basically, we had the Transcon market out of there, and it was just, you know, just San Francisco and LAX, but there were enough people that were loyal to the JFK Transcon market that when we pulled out, we gave them an opportunity to fly someone else for those flights. And then we might have also lost them to other routes where there might have been competition because they still didn't want to go to Newark for places where we could do like long haul nonstop.
I mean, but at the same time, weren't they losing money on the JFK routes? That was the rumor, right?
That was the rumor. So the other thing, and we talked about this with Air India last week, I think, of like they were losing money on 93% of their routes. Not that Air India is a good example of someone you want to be compared to when talking about if you're making money or not as an airline, but the idea of like any individual route can show profit or loss, but in aggregate, the network is what matters. And this is also, you know, a Kirbyism and just a United. Like, remember when United de-hubbed Cleveland, like 3 months prior, every flight in and out of Cleveland is profitable. It's a great operation for us. And then, boom, oh, actually, it was a shit show. We're not hubbing there anymore. Right? So there's those numbers, I feel like, can be manipulated or tweaked to represent whatever the airline wants it to be at the time it's reporting the information.
So now as you talk about, you know, you mentioned long-haul flights potentially, is that what you're getting at with what's happening at JFK? Could United go to long haul stuff out of JFK?
I doubt it. I would assume it's a resumption of the Transcon stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have plenty of incoming PS planes. They have, you know, the 752s right now. There'll be the MAX 10s coming online soon enough, and with the market depressed in other segments for some time, splitting that traffic across to JFK might make sense. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Someone suggested it was retribution at JetBlue for them, for JetBlue expanding so much at Newark. I mean, I feel like this is one of the things that's like long discussed. So maybe, you know, not really retribution, but also if they actually finally do it, maybe there was a triggering action. The interesting part to me is the slots. And I had to look this up today and figure it out. Foz already knew it. So, you know, too bad he's not here to tell me. I told you so. The whole Delta United slot swap thing. I knew it fell apart when the Department of Justice decided to sue United against the deal. This was back in 2015. Delta was going to take, I think, 45 slots or like 20-something pairs from United at JFK, and United was going to take a dozen or two from Delta at Newark, and it was going to give United more than 75% of the total slots at Newark, and DOJ decided maybe that's just too much.
But
and they dropped the deal. But then also, Newark went from dropped a level of, so it's no longer slot controlled, it's just slot limited.
Yep, that's what I was going
to
ask.
Right, it went from like level 3 to level 2 or whatever.
Yeah.
Oops, sorry. I was drinking there. I thought you were still talking.
I said, yeah. I was wondering about that. And so
like, that was the other thing. It's like, so then all of a sudden, like, Delta didn't have to give them the slots because United could theoretically sort of do whatever it wanted.
Mm-hmm.
There's still some limits, but it's not quite as strict as true slot controls. So, but yeah, I went and looked, and the DOT still believe, or, you know, on record as having United owning those slots, and they're just leased to Delta. So that, I guess, that I don't know what the terms of those leases are and when they're allowed to sort of not revoke or reclaim the slots, but that seems like something that's likely to happen.
Yeah.
If United decides that JFK is where it wants to be, that seems how it would happen.
Yeah, and it's okay. So let's talk about that potential for a minute. Where would they be at JFK? Like, they can't go back to T7, right? Like,
why not?
Isn't T7 now all Cathay and BA? Or not Cathay, Alaska and BA?
Well, has it reopened is the first question I have, right? Because for a while, T7 closed.
Okay.
And everybody just basically moved. Most of them moved to T8. BA and Cathay moved to T8. I think Cathay permanently moved to T8 a while ago.
They're permanently there.
Some of the other airlines moved to T4. Like, part of it comes down to just, like, where's it going to happen? Will they go to T4 on this sort of international side that's not Delta's because Swiss is there and they can get a deal with Swissport to manage it? I don't know. There's the Lufthansa gates over in T1, and Lufthansa owns a portion of that terminal, but depending on time of day, it gets super busy at night.
I think if they said they're going to fly to T1, I think I would say, screw that, I'll fly someone else.
Rather drive to Newark. at 4:45 through tunnels on both sides. T1's such a hole.
It is.
I don't know, but at the same time, you know, we can joke about, like, would you even go out of T1 if that's where it was? But also, like, there are so many passengers that don't care about that sort of thing. Like, that's where the plane is. That's where I went.
Yeah. Well, I just wonder, like, security is such a madhouse there. It's just not a fun, it's not a good experience.
No, nothing is good about T1. I get it. I know where you're coming from. But, like, if that's where the planes are and people want to fly United, that's where they're going to go. Like, I think that's, like, a tertiary or quaternary consideration compared to, like, what was the fare? What's the timing? What's the airline?
Yeah, not everyone is me, is what you're saying. So,
or me.
And I, you know, I actually, depending on the time of day, I would actually love to fly into JFK, like, and depending on where I have to go. So if I have to go, you know, somewhere in Brooklyn, done deal. So, I don't know. I mean, I like the idea. I just don't.
But you don't have any decent connections out of Portland anyways, do you?
Not on United. San Francisco. That would be it, really. Can't get LA. Just rub it in. It's cool. Whatever.
That's what I'm here for.
The FAA administrator is going to fly the 737 MAX before it returns to service. Does this make you feel better?
About what?
Flying the 737 MAX?
No. It makes me feel better about the current government's willingness to showboat for no particular apparent reason. pilot. I get it. But he hasn't been an active pilot for some time. And so, like, I would trust people that actually work regularly on the type. Like, he's going to do the training course. He's going to do the simulator, and then he's going to fly the plane because he promised to. And, like, you know, I don't know. It smells like bullshit to me.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not like Boeing's going to be able to move the planes anywhere right now anyway, even if this whole thing gets approved.
Southwest says said not that long ago, it still is ready to take deliveries and retire the older ones. I believe United's on record as saying the same, so some of them will move.
Yeah, well, that's good.
I don't know about foreign carriers and other options there, but I think those two at least have been on record as saying they're ready.
Sure. Brexit is allowing consolidated European ATC management to happen.
So this is hysterical to me. So there's been this concept of a single European sky for air traffic management. Right now, I don't remember the numbers, but I think it's 26 different national air service providers.
Okay.
Across the EU, managing something like 50 odd different air traffic control centers. Right, and the US has way fewer than that. The US has like 14 or 15, I think.
Yep.
Right, so. Something in that range, in the teens. And it's, right, the center is like, we manage this large region of upper level space for en route airplanes, and we make sure that they're spaced correctly. For years now, European airlines have sort of been begging the Eurocontrol, which manages it, and especially all the governments that manage the different controller systems, to coordinate the traffic flow. And there's like some of the studies, you know, the statistics from IATA about, like, you know, a flight from Palma de Mallorca to Stockholm will go through like 18 different frequency switches along the way, and crazy statistics like that. It's just, it's too much different stuff happening along the way. And because air traffic control routes are still the sort of not point to point, but connect the dots concept of get where you need to go, but you have to do it within the sort of highways in the sky, they're terribly inefficient. And so air traffic control and airlines alike have estimated somewhere between 6 and 10% fuel and time savings if they can do a sort of single European sky that's commonly managed and doesn't have to deal with all those challenges, let's say, of the air traffic control environment. So
makes sense. Yeah.
Right. Like, and that's a big deal. 6 to 10% on, you know, is the emissions alone is huge, but also like the time, and just, it's big.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And I've been covering the industry a long time. I've been to the IATA briefings. I've been in it. And they always keep talking about it and keep talking about it. And no one ever explained why it wasn't happening. And it turns out that the European Commission issued a briefing last week basically saying, we are finally ready to implement this. We're going to take the, you know, proposals from 2013 and 2018 and some of the older stuff and revise them a tiny bit. But basically it's going to be as it was previously written. And now we're ready to implement it. And in the FAQ, there's a question of, you know, why now, essentially?
Mm-hmm.
And the response is, because of Brexit, there's no longer debate over the role of Gibraltar in the EU skies, and so we can just go ahead and get it done. Basically, Britain had been blocking this for more than a decade because of Gibraltar. and I want to say in not so many words, but that's more or less exactly what they wrote.
Wow.
Yeah, so because of Brexit, because Britain is no longer, you know, voting member in the European Commission, in the European Union, they can say, like, okay, now we can all do all these things. So it's a little bit of irony there to me of, like, yes, Britain was in fact trying to screw the environment and everything else.
Wow. Crazy. United and Hawaiian are adding COVID tests for Hawaiian flights, for flights to Hawaii, to and from
late,
Hawaii.
Late breaking news. American is as well. They announced it late this afternoon.
And then JetBlue is doing that same thing for a number of Caribbean routes.
Late breaking news. American is too. Just announced it this afternoon.
So they're doing Hawaii and the Caribbean.
So American's plan, they're the most recent news, it's on top of mind. American is for flights to Jamaica from Miami.
Okay.
They'll be offering a test, and initially it's only for Jamaican citizens because they'll be able to avoid the home quarantine if they arrive with a negative test. And the goal is to expand it to all arrivals into Jamaica and then also to the Bahamas and other CARICOM countries, which is the Caribbean region. And then from DFW to, I want to say, Maui and Honolulu, American will have tests at a DFW. And similar to the United and Hawaiian and JetBlue, they'll have mail-in option. The Jamaica flights, I want to say there's a, I can't remember if Miami has on-premise testing as an option also. I know that DFW is supposed to have on-premise testing, just like United has at SFO. And then Hawaiian and JetBlue is mail-in only. Hawaiian is mail-in or drive-through.
Hmm.
So they're all a little different. They're all expensive, which is, you know, if you have to go, I certainly would say pay for a test rather than sit in a hotel room or, you know, isolated for 14 days. But United, I think, quoted the highest price of $250 for the walk-up testing at SFO. And one of the lower prices for mail-in testing, I think it was about $80 for a mail-in test. JetBlue was like $130 or $140. American was $125, I think, for the mail-in. I don't know what Hawaiian was pricing at. And so, none of these prices are set by the airlines. I'm saying that because those are the partners the airlines are working with. The prices are all set by the labs.
Gotcha. What about the idea of connections? Like, how does that work? If you're connecting, you can still do the test beforehand, or is it only
a mail-in? Obviously, yes. One of the theories is, like, if you have a long enough connection, you could probably get the test. You know, it's 15-minute results in the terminal, so. You know, if you have an hour-long connection, in theory, you can do the first flight, go get your test, and then run back and get on the plane. You'd probably want at least 90 minutes for that. And then who got it, you know, were you communicable on the first test if you test negative? There's some interesting challenges. Or excuse me, if you test positive. There's some interesting challenges. There's also Lufthansa announced that it's going to do a similar thing, but they're going to switch to the IXNOW or something like that. It's a
new 15-minute one that's, like, cheap.
That's the cheap one. So there's the ID now and the Bricks now or something like that. I forget it's something with an X in it. It starts with a B and has an X at the end, and there's a bunch of letters in the middle, and I always get them wrong. Both are Abbott Labs. The ID now test is more expensive. It's a PCR test, not an antigen test. And depending on where you're going, some countries require PCR and some require antigen. Panama just announced today that it's going to reopen its borders in 2 weeks on the 12th of October, and they will accept either test. As a negative. So if you have, you know, the $5 high volume production Abbott Labs test that, you know, you can just get on the way out the door, you get your results in 15 minutes, is an antigen test. If the country you're going to will accept that, that's great. Right now, Hawaii is saying PCR only. I think Jamaica is as well, and I don't know about the rest of the Caribbean. So there's some interesting challenges in terms of what tests are being accepted. And I screwed this up earlier, so there's a difference between antigen and antibody. So things
like that. And what about, so like you said, Lufthansa, is Germany opening up if you have a negative test?
I think it's for leaving Germany.
Okay, I got you.
So I'm not sure where.
I was getting a little excited that we might be able to fly somewhere.
I'm not sure where you can go and what the details are in the Germany one, but that's
interesting. Europe's top court has approved regulation of Airbnb. So the European Court of Justice backs the French law regulating Airbnb. This is bad news for Airbnb, right?
Probably.
Yeah. And it's basically saying, you know, short-term
rentals. Please stop using all of our reasonable apartment buildings that people should be living in as hotels.
Yes.
It's probably bad news for me, too.
You like Airbnb. In Europe, even?
Yeah.
I think I've stayed at one Airbnb in Europe, and it was okay. Nothing spectacular.
I've had some that were good, some that were bad, but I care a lot more about location than other things, and especially like for a trade show or whatever, I just need somewhere like I like to be able to come. They're all suites essentially, right? Like I'm guaranteed a couch.
Yeah,
assuming I book the place that has one. But like, you know, just trade show week in Hamburg, the decent hotels sell out well in advance, and the ones that don't sell out are very expensive, and you can get an Ibis Express or whatever their shit brand is. And I did that 1 year and it was terrible, but you know, it was like 90 euros a night for a room that's normally 30 when it's not convention week. And it was good enough location in that it was walkable to the show, but whatever. And if I can pay roughly that much for like a proper apartment with a fridge and a kitchen, and like I can stock up and have breakfast every morning ready to go, I like that. And so we've talked about this off and on many times in the past. Do I like the fact that I'm probably displacing someone who should be living there as a real resident? No. I was pissy about it when people in my apartment building in New York City were trying to use their apartments for it, but I'm a hypocritical jackass. I'm proud of it.
Emirates MasterCard now includes elite status. Wow.
So first year only, but they have two tiers. They're like, you know, $100 a year and the $500 a year-ish ballpark prices. I closed that tab, so I don't have it open to read off the numbers. But basically, the like basic level card gives you silver status for the first year, and the high level card comes with the priority pass select and all those other things, and also gold status for the year. And it's, hello, co-brand. Someone's paying. Good for the loyalty program. Right now, like, who cares about the number of elites you have a little bit? I don't know.
Skytrax.
I'm going to go drink some more. Excuse me.
Chatham Convair 580s are retiring in New Zealand.
Yeah.
It's a sad day. We can pour one out on the curb.
Yeah, I'm going to burn my throat. I don't want to.
For the Convair 580.
Convair 580. These are like, what, 50 or 60 years old at this point?
Yeah, I actually have one in my flight memory. A couple, actually. From flying it in Canada on Norliner.
They're still flying 734s and like just retrofitted a bunch of them.
Yeah, yeah, they got it. And they have, I think they still have 732s with whisper kits. So
on the gravel?
Yeah.
I mean, what else are you going to fly into gravel? Like, no one else is stupid enough to let you fly their planes on that stuff.
hey, we'll get to that in the after show.
Okay. But no, this is one of those weird things. It was Air Chatham, like, flew to random islands off of New Zealand and still had been flying these 580s. And apparently COVID related, they're just like, yeah, too expensive. Can't keep them in service anymore. We're done. I haven't gone and looked to see what else they're flying in the place. So that's an interesting question, because I can't imagine they're going to.
Yeah, it makes me wonder what like Buffalo Air up in Canada is going to do with the DC-3s and things.
I can't imagine the DC-3s. They've got – actually, Air Chatham's has DC-3s also. They also have Saab 340s and ATR-72s. So it sounds like the 72s are going to be what replaces the Convair. The Convair 580 is the fastest turboprop in the New Zealand skies.
Wow.
And they describe the Saab 340 as their Swedish princess. They have Metroliners?
I've flown on one of those, too.
See, I don't think I have the Metroliner.
Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, yeah, it's sad. You know, it was one of those, like, sort of historic things that you could have done. And they were the last place, I think, you could get them commercially. So, at this point, I guess you got to convince Honeywell to let you on board. They've got a test plane that was originally used, or maybe not originally, but at one point was a NASA test plane and has, yeah, a serious history. It's a pretty cool plane. That's my 580 experiences with the Honeywell test kit.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Singapore is saying there will not be any flights to nowhere.
Thank goodness.
They were going to just fly around, right?
So this is something that's been happening all, I'd say, around the world, but it's mostly in Australasia, if that's a place that we are allowed to use that word. Qantas did a couple. Ava, I think, did some. ANA was doing it. The idea of, like, oh, people want to get on airplanes. Let us take our airplanes out and fly them, but not go anywhere. And, like, I get sightseeing. I'm a fan of that, too. But at some level, perhaps it is time to consider that just flying a plane around for the sake of giving people a meal on board, and, like, with the, I don't know, the pressurization turned on. I'm not sure what the real value proposition there is probably not a great environmental impact and of questionable value in other ways. And so Singapore Airlines has chosen a slightly different approach. They're still going to try to use their A380s and some of their other resources to make money on the ground, though, not flying. And so they've got a couple days at the end of October, like the weekend of the 24th and 5th, where you can book in for seats on board one of the 380s. And there's a little bit of a tour, and then at Changi, but then you get on board and, like, you'll be served a meal on board. Groups up to five, and they've noted that you are welcome to watch a movie while you're dining. They're going to have the IFE turned on and use the duty-free shopping, which raises questions about whether it's really duty-free and what the tax implications are, but sure. So yeah, they're doing a couple little cute little things like that. That's actually the least interesting of the things that Singapore announced, in my opinion. Well, because there were sort of three levels of what they announced. The other one was in November, and they said it's for the school break season, which is weirdly around Thanksgiving time, so I'm not sure what school break is in Singapore, but assuming they're celebrating the U.S. Thanksgiving, they're going to have options of sort of like behind-the-scenes tours at the training center. There's going to be an option for – you can buy in for flight simulator time. You can buy in for flight attendant training, quote-unquote, and that's mostly for kids. Where they get to, like, sort of pretend to serve passengers, like a little training course, then serve passengers in business class on one of the 380s, which is kind of cool. And they get to get a uniform that they get to take home. And then the ever awkward, if you want to be a Singapore girl, come hang out with our in-flight training supervisors, and we'll teach you how to put on your makeup.
That is a little weird.
And then, so that's one set. And then there's the third thing that they're doing, which is dining at home. They've had their catering operation start doing home delivery of meals. And it's business class or first class. You choose which menu you want. The menu can include wine. And the Singapore wine cellar is spectacular. So, like, opening that up, they have to use it. You can't just keep wine forever. And so opening that up, like, if you order the first class option, a bottle of Dom 2008 vintage champagne is one of the options. I think it's with the all-inclusive first class, or if you just do the caviar course. But you get, like, a bottle of champagne, caviar, and all the accoutrements, and they bring it to your house in Singapore. So that's kind of cool. But where it gets super interesting to me is, like, there's different levels within all of this, up to the all-inclusive first class, which is the full meal service, including a bottle of champagne and a bottle of Burgundy and all the meals. And you can pick which menu you want to order from. And I think it also includes the caviar, yada, yada, yada. And that seems pretty – and the amenity kits and the sleep suit. Yeah. So in your house, you can put on your airline pajamas. And, you know, put the eye mask on the top of your head while you're sitting there with your amenity kit, and then eat the meal at your dining room table.
Do they deliver to the United States?
They do not.
Dang it.
What's super, though, like, and I keep saying super interesting, and it keeps getting better and better and better. The in this sort of first class level of whatever, that seems pretty luxurious and ridiculous. But it also includes a video of how you're supposed to set up your meal and how to plate it. Oh, and by the way, there's options that either it comes with the food or it comes with a 22-piece place setting.
Oh my God. Only Singapore would do this.
Right? They've got like they've got a budget for breakage, and whether it's legitimately things get broken or they get stolen, pilfered, liberated, use your term of choice. They expect some of this to happen, and so and like they're retiring a bunch of these fines. They're not going to need all the stuff. So, but it's a full 22-piece place setting, including all the silverware and plates and such, and glassware.
I'm pretty sure I still have one set of my continental china.
Nice. I don't think I have anything continental. I really, really love my Cubana wine glass, though.
I
have zero regrets about stealing that.
But anyway, this is awesome.
So all of that, like, you can get the full table, like the full place settings, all that stuff in the all-inclusive package is fine. Or you can book the chef. There's an option where you can contact the customer concierge, and they will actually send someone over to plate it for you in your house if you don't even want to do that part.
Wow.
And that I find absolutely amazing and ridiculous and wonderful.
Oh my gosh. My head hurts.
And it's not book the cook and like you can order a lobster thermidor, which I'm going to upset a lot of people now and say you should never do. It's a terrible thing to do to lobster.
You mean putting cheese on a lobster is wrong?
Yes, I mean that explicitly. Don't at me. Do at me. I don't care. Let's go. I live in New England now. Cheese on lobster. It was never a good idea. I'm just still bitter from. Remember when there's been a couple times where Singapore Air mistakenly opened up first class award seats.
Yes.
And so I got on the San Francisco Hong Kong flight, and it turned out that we booked it just randomly on a Saturday or Sunday, but that was the day. I think it was a Sunday. It must have been because that was the day. It was like the first service of the new season, and Singapore had switched to the 380 from the 777, so we went from F to R, so we got suites, and it was booked just into the suites class because they didn't have an award booking bucket for it at the time.
Yeah,
and so me and my wife showed up, and we were like, "Yes, we are your suites customers for the day, sitting in this lovely double bed in the middle. Thank you." But she ordered the lobster thermidor because she wanted to try it, and I tried to talk her out of it, and I ordered the steak because I knew that would actually be good, and she ended up eating the steak because she didn't like lobster, and I should have just asked what other food they had. And like, obviously, I didn't go hungry. It was fine. But I'm a little bitter still that, like, I was stuck with a lobster thermidor. That wasn't very knowing that I didn't want it, but it was still suggested that I eat it anyways.
Yes, exactly. I think that's a show. What do you think?
I should probably stop talking for a little while and hope she doesn't listen.
To our listeners, thanks for listening to us this week. You can support us on Patreon if you'd like and get a little extra content at the end of the show. And follow us on Twitter at dotslines, more dots, more lines.com. Thanks, and happy travel soon. Bye-bye.
Talk to you later.